All right. It's 1:35, so let's start. Welcome back. You know the rules after lunch, right? We will not dim the lights and you will not sleep. Definitely not snore. Okay? So those are the three rules. Okay? So we will enjoy. That's the fourth positive rule. So we have the first speaker after lunch, Mr. Tim Hudson. He's a CTO and Technical Director, Cryptsoft. And he's been involved in network and system security for more than 20 years. He has extensive experience in various security architectures. He is, more impressively, he co-founded the RSA Security Australia Development Center in 1998. And was responsible for advancing the development and deployment of the RSA BSAFE range of security toolkits. He also guided the 140-dash validation of multiple cryptographic toolkits. Mr. Hudson is technical director at Cryptsoft Australia, and we welcome him. And Mr. Hudson is also an OpenSSL team member and a co-editor across multiple standards of documents. Welcome, Mr. Tim Hudson.
Thank you. Hopefully everybody's nice and relaxed after lunch. What I'm actually going to do here is go through a fair amount of material, and I'd encourage anybody who finds something that doesn't make sense or is just curious about it, feel free to interrupt. You don't have to save questions till the end. Happy to take interruptions during the presentation. I'm going to go through a fair amount of stuff today, and we'll just launch straight into it. So, key management. You know, who cares about key management? Well, in reality, lots and lots of people care about key management. People care about key management so much, there are multiple conflicting, overlapping, and contradictory key management standards. Here's a subset of some of the standards that are out there in the market. So, of course, the NSA's got to do its own standard because the NSA's always going to do its own standard. There's two standards within OASIS. One of them's the EKMI, one's KMIP. EKMI's kind of dead. ANSI, well, if you're in the financial services space, well, you're special because it deals with money, so you have your own standard. The storage guys in IEEE decided they wanted their own standard and then nobody wanted to implement it, so it got shut down. The IETF, well, they're independent, so they always do their own thing. NIST thinks key management so important, there's actually three special publications that cover it, including a key management, cryptographic key management framework and a federal profile for it. And of course, well, ISO doesn't want to get left out, so there's an ISO key management standard. In fact, I could list six or seven others here. So the standards bodies care about key management, and generally that means somebody somewhere told the standards people key management was important. So let's have a look at it in the context of a FITS module. If you break down the test requirements across the vendor evidence statements, the assertions, and the test evidence statements with inside a FITS 140-2 validation, you may not realize, but there's an awful lot of things about key management. And in a FITS 140-2 context, key management is about managing the keys inside the module. It's not about broader key management, but even in this context, if you sat down and have a look at it, hey, I'm a software module. If you look across all the designs, well, software module, you get your physical from the platform you're running on, so it's kind of irrelevant. Self-tests are what you do when you're getting your module validated, so they don't really apply at runtime. So the single largest requirements area that impacts a cryptographic module at the software level is actually all about key management. And we turn around and have a look at, well, NIST, Special Pub 800-130, the Cryptographic Key Management Framework. It's a massive standard with a whole pile of requirements. And a lot of it covers exactly what you're meant to do with keys and metadata. So if we flip back across to 140-2, we're talking about 120 requirements sitting in the key management space, about the same sitting in key management but from a system level perspective. And each of the requirements are broken down. So the NIST framework for cryptographic key management systems itself is pretty broad and breaks it down in these areas of detail. Now, if we go and have a look at the federal profile, and the federal profile, which is covered in 800-152, breaks it down further between the things that are recommended, in other words, you know, or the actual requirements, they're sitting there in the I think it shows up as light purple. The base requirements, you have to do these. The next ones is you kind of should do these, and the ones in green are, it'd be nice if you thought about doing these. So the requirements went broken down into what would become a testing framework if cryptographic key management systems had a testing framework, is indicating there's going to be a whole pile more requirements and more focus just on key management. So ducking back two slides, if the FIPS program was expanded to cover key management, that one little section in Area 7 would break down into something like this, which would have to be incorporated. So key management is a lot broader and a lot more detailed than what's currently covered in any validation testing program. That's why it's important. Well, why would anybody want a common key management standard? Why would customers be interested in anything along these lines? So we turn around and have a look at it. Everybody had their own vendor proprietary key management solution back in, you know, the dim dark days of about a decade ago. Every vendor had a key management solution. Every vendor had a key management protocol. And none of them worked with each other. And if you wanted to turn around and as an application developer, get a piece of equipment that worked with multiple vendor servers, you had to either implement the protocols if they were published, or you had to get the SDKs from each of the vendors and see if you could make them work together, which is kind of fun at times when the vendors picked different versions of components that weren't binary compatible. So along came KMIP, the OASIS Key Management Interoperability Protocol, and its view is, let's forget about all these APIs, let's focus on a wire protocol. Let's make it so that there is one way to talk to a key management system and design something that enables meeting all of the requirements of all possible key management scenarios in a single, unified, public, open protocol. So what's the good things about having a single protocol? It means you only have to do one integration. That's kind of good if you're a developer. It means the terminology that you use in your documentation and your customers' approaches becomes common, because naturally around the standard when you develop products, you tend to reuse the terminology of the standard. You'll get more choice. That's got to be good. And you know, because it's all the same standard, everything should just work together, because you know, once you publish a standard, all the implementations just operate. The negatives, of course, is, well, if you've got a standard, you kind of have to follow it, which means whatever you're currently doing has got to change. Whatever you've spent the last 10 years doing, well, your vocabulary might have to change across as well. You might have to implement more than what you had in your current product, and your end users will expect to be able to do more because they look, hey, the standard lets me do that, why doesn't your product? So what are people doing with enterprise key management? What people are doing with a common key management protocol? So across these three industry sectors, and I'm not going to read the materials on the slide, just give you an idea, lots of vendors have gone and got products where the key management is externalized and able to interoperate. Now go back 10 years, you couldn't draw this sort of slide. In fact, go back 6 years, you couldn't draw this slide. No vendor's product worked with other vendors' products in general. Now it's mix and match, pick and choose. So how did this get achieved? Well, by focusing on a wire protocol. So forget the upper layers and just concentrate on encoding and decoding at a wire protocol format level. And if we have a look at what's sitting inside KMIP itself, make sure you can do everything anybody might ever want to dream of in the way of key management in the one protocol. So the entire life cycle for key management, from creation to retirement, destruction, the ability to turn around and do things like rekey, the ability to set policies and handle it in a cross-vendor, open, vendor-neutral format, and the ability to do the usual sort of stuff that you want to be able to turn around and do in terms of finding out when things change. So yeah, if somebody changes, you know, the policy on this key, I'd like to be told about it. Those sorts of capabilities have to sit in a key management standard. And the other thing, in order to unify HSMs and key management systems, a full set of cryptographic perimeters. So if you want to be able to perform a cryptographic operation, you should be able to do it locally on your system, or be able to ask a key manager to do it on your behalf. And those are all the things sitting down the bottom that got added in version 1.2 of the spec. So KMIP specification, if you haven't read it, how many people here are familiar with KMIP? Right, about a third to a half. Right, so if you're not familiar with it, it's a about a 400-page spec. High-level overview of what's sitting in KMIP. The model is objects have values, values are immutable. So if you want to rekey a key, that means you make another key. You can't change the value, you can't change the key material. But of course you can have an object where there is no key material because the key material might be somewhere else. But you can still do policy management on the object. All objects have got to have types, so it's a strongly typed system, allowing for the full range of cryptographic objects, including the concept of stuff that you don't know about. So the opaque object type is the key management system doesn't know what it's dealing with, but it can handle the policy around it. And then metadata. You must have metadata about the cryptographic objects. And this is one of the things that something like 140-2 simply ignores. In the context of performing any meaningful end-user policy handling or any decisions, you need some information to make those decisions. You need semantics. Where is this key being used? What's it being used for? What's its purpose? Not just what's its algorithm, what's its key length. You can't make meaningful decisions around that except at a fairly gross level. So KMIP wires in the concept of keep the information and the metadata with the key. Keep all of the material there. And by the way, as a standard, admit up front that you're not going to be able to document everything anybody might want to be able to put against a key. So you have to allow for the fact that a server vendor may have its own view of nice things to attach to a key. So may a client vendor. So you've got to have both client and server custom attributes and wire it in as a base capability in the protocol itself. So all objects within KMIP have got a fixed set of attributes. You've got to be able to identify them, say what they are. And if it's a cryptographic object, you've got to know some things about the crypto, what sort of algorithm it is. And within the actual certificate objects, the usual things you need to know about a certificate if you're going to do any lookups. So distinguished name-related information for the subject and issuer. If we have a look at the life cycle, well, everybody knows that 800-57 is the ultimate life cycle for the life, the universe, and everything of keys, so KMIP simply adopted it. The KMIP key management life cycle is NIST Special Pub 800-57 in all of its glory. So there's a state attribute. It has the NIST permitted states and the NIST permitted transitions. And every transition, you've got to record when it happened or when you would like it to happen, so there's a range of date attributes. So you can get a model within the system. It's fairly flexible. And it has to be flexible because it's got to be able to support anything anybody might want to do with a key management system. Down at the encoding level, the wire protocol is trivial. 3 bytes for a tag, 1 byte for a type, 4 bytes for a length, and then the payload. Couldn't get much simpler. Tag, type, length, value. And when you turn around and have a look at a message from a KMIP perspective, this is what it looks like. So the first highlighted item there is the tag, followed by the type, followed by the length, and then the remainder is the payload. There's another colour in there that I hadn't mentioned before. There's also padding. KMIP aligns on 8-byte boundaries, simply because somebody early on in the specification thought that would make things faster. If you have a look at what a KMIP message looks like, this is the same message from back here. Simply put in the XML representation. So KMIP is a binary standard. The TTLV encoding is mandatory. But there's also support for an XML representation that's optional. So this is the message a client of the key management system would send to the server saying, please create me an AES 128-bit key. I plan to use it for encrypt and decrypt. That's what the key management client sends to the server. If we want to express it in JSON, exactly the same message in JSON. So if you're coming out of a web-centric space or you just have to like JSON, you can use this representation. And you sit down and have a think. You know, it's a simple standard. There's tags, there's types, there's lengths, there's values. It's pretty straightforward. Everybody's going to do an interoperable implementation. We're not going to have any problems. Well, one of the things that we noticed as basically a technology provider in the space, the number of independent, successful, interoperable implementations of KMIP by a vendor is zero. Everybody gets something wrong. And what they get wrong is different. So, yeah, padding, encoding, tag values, lengths, orders, TLS usage, making mandatory things optional, making optional things mandatory. And there's nothing like turning around and inverting those two across a couple of major vendors to immediately break interoperability. So if you follow the rules as a client, it won't work with this server. If you don't follow the rules, it won't work with the conforming server. So these are all the sorts of things that sort of face the KMIP community over the last 5 years or so. And then a little bit more complicated issues, right? Missing major blocks of functionality. Now, there are even vendors who turn around and say, yeah, that nest state thing, I don't think that's important. We'll leave that out. It's mandatory in the standard. Doesn't mean you have to implement it. But if you're turning around and basically making decisions based on key state, really hard to do if key state isn't being recorded and adhered to. Adding extra bits, like you must include this vendor extension, or if this field isn't present, I'm not going to work. Confusion about some concepts within the specification that were fairly flexibly worded to keep technical committee members happy to allow two different interpretations to be possible. They're the sorts of things that as a technical committee over the last 5 years we've fixed. We even had vendors that assume that a client will turn around and always send messages in a particular order. So it's a free-form protocol, it's stateless, but you can imply a state on it, and if you build an implementation around that way, it's not going to interoperate. Getting the encoding rules wrong is something that you would expect never to happen in a standard that includes a set of test cases with an example of the binary encoding in it. How can you as a developer make fundamental mistakes like this? Well, it's very common. You know, there's a set of rules, the rules run over about three pages, and there's a set of examples of following the rules. But not every developer, it seems, turns around and works from test cases backwards to get interoperable implementations. A good example here. This is exactly what is sitting in the spec. So the details in section 9.1.1.3, when you're coding the length, it's exactly like this. Here's the rule. The rule is complete. Depending on the data type, this is how the length is calculated, and depending on this, this is what you've got to do for padding. So pretty much every possible misinterpretation that can be applied to this one item has occurred in the field. And yeah, it's required some pretty creative interpretations, but you know, putting the padding in the wrong place before rather than after, you know, how do you read that into the spec? But it doesn't matter how much documentation you add into the spec. Somebody's going to turn around and find a creative way of not following it. So as a technical committee, we sat down and figured out more text is not the right answer. Right? More text that the developer also won't read is not the right answer. More examples of exactly what the test output should be is also not the right answer because the developer didn't read the first lot of examples. So yeah, hit me harder with exactly the same thing that's not working doesn't work. There's got to be a different strategy for turning around and handling that. So the only way to ensure that you have interoperability in an interoperability specification is to interoperate with other implementations. So as a technical committee, and these are the sorts of things that we've sat down and had many arguments in the technical committee, is more testing is the only way to prove everything's working. So more plug fests, more interops, defining more tests of more capability when you get the complex misinterpretation errors, make more tests, but then test them. And you need to get a formal conformance testing program in place. Because if vendors have an opportunity to make a mistake and launch a product, if there's no independent third party, then you have an issue of it's one vendor arguing against another and customers don't pay much attention to that. So unlike in the FIPS space where there is the cryptographic module validation program, there isn't a key management validation program run by NIST or CSE. So we had to turn around and figure out a different solution to that. Conceptual confusion is another area that I'm sort of drilling down to in a little more here. Policy management. Now I lightly mentioned the word policy and you need additional information or attributes against an object to be able to perform any meaningful decision making or any policy enforcement. Try and have an interesting conversation between two vendors in the key management space. Get them to explain what policy means. There are no two vendors that have the same definition of even conceptually what policy is trying to handle. And that makes it very difficult to turn around and in an environment where you say, oh, that looks like a bit of policy, I'll go and implement it this way, to get things to go together. So, you know, automatic creation of objects is effectively a side effect of other operations. What do you do with password fields? So some vendors view of, well, you send me a password, I'm not going to bother to check it. And my policy is you shouldn't be doing password checks. So I'll happily tell you whatever's there is okay. Even if there's no password or the password is wrong, I'm going to let that request through. Requiring that every object be named. Well, KMIP doesn't require names. Names are optional. But you know, I want every user to have to put a name on things. So that breaks interoperability. And character sets. So the way we've turned around and handled some of these things is each time we hit an issue within the spec, we're going to remove the functionality if it's just generally unable to be agreed on. We're going to turn around and, you know, make sure that if there's some funny behavior a particular vendor wants, there's a way of finding out, is this going to happen? And you know, if people are going to turn around and basically put names in and they expect them not to be unique, we need to allow for that within the system. So there's a range of issues there that have to be handled from a key management perspective. And you're trying to think, what's this got to do with security? Why is this important from a key management point of view? And what it all comes down to is, how do users identify the cryptographic objects that are in the key management system? And a lot of users, you'll find in the real world, you may be able to hand out a unique identifier, but they have nowhere to store it. They already have their own view on how objects are named, where names are meant to come from, and they're going to continue to use it and have no place or space or mechanism that would allow storing another name. So the naming schemes that are used in every product end up coming into a key management system. So the key management system has to be fairly broad to be able to handle it. In terms of people who try and game the system and just do pattern matching in a test case environment, the only way to really handle that is change the tests. So that's what you have to do. If people are recognizing a test is occurring and giving pre-canned responses, change the test sequence. When people are turning around and basically, you know, looking at the message sequences and context, mix them up again. Figure out that it's going on. Change the rules. Break it. Because basically, if you've got a simple test program in place, if there's a way of passing the test with doing less work, some vendor somewhere is going to try and do it. So, conformance testing, independent conformance testing is effectively the main way you have to be able to turn around and demonstrate that a given vendor product follows a specification. You can't rely on the vendor to just turn around and go hand on heart, oh, I followed the rules and it works, especially not when you're in an environment where we have demonstration of zero interoperable implementations at first interop test. So, as a vendor community in the key management space under the OASIS KMIP technical committee, we sat down and figured out, yeah, a fair number of the members are in the storage space. There's a storage testing body. Why don't we get them to run a key management testing program? So under the Storage Networking Industry Association in the Storage Security Industry Forum, there is a formal conformance testing program for key management systems that conform to KMIP. And that allows vendors to be able to basically say, take your product in, get somebody else to test it, and they publish the results of it. So you have to have some level of independent testing. So for a cryptographic module, go and get it tested under the CMVP. For a key management module, go and get it tested at SNEAR under the SSIF. And again, well, you can't test everything in a spec. You need to turn around and say, hey, I only need a little piece of the specification for my context. So as a technical committee, we had to define profiles. We had to break the usage down to logically meaningful sets of functionality to enable conformance testing to be possible. We didn't need to break down the functionality for any reason other than conformance testing to make sense. So there's a range of profiles documented there at the bottom. You know, if you're turning around and using a storage array with a self-encrypting drive, your requirements from a key management system are as complicated as vaulting the authentication phrase used to unlock the drive. You need nothing more. You're going to create that and you're going to read it. You're probably never going to destroy it. And you don't need to have any asymmetric functionality. You don't need to have any generation because you've created that outside of the key management system because it's a passphrase, it's not actually a cryptographic key. So if you have a look at the storage array with self-encrypting drive profiles, it's very straightforward. It implements probably about, you know, 10% of the KMIP specification. And you can go and get a product conformance tested that just does that functionality. So it's like, you know, picking the algorithm tests which algorithms you'll support in a FIPS validation, only this is more a series of operations in a key management system with some fundamentals underneath. So the way you go about testing, and this is a little bit different to the FIPS 140-2 validation program, is you actually hand your implementation over. If you're a server, you hand it over to the test team. Give them some documentation and they run the tests. Everything's handled under the test team's control, and then you get past the results and you get told you pass or you fail. If you fail, you can take another round of testing, and you can choose whether or not the results are published, and only positive results are ever published. So effectively, if you're a client, you point your test system at one of the test servers and get a report spat out the end. If you're a server, you send your server along and a test system is pointed at your server to get interoperability test results. And then, yay, you get a badge. It goes up on a website. So you can turn around and basically say, go to this location and there's where you'll find all of your key management systems that have been certified. And that's just a snapshot from a little while ago. So the test results are always published. The results remain confidential. The fact that you're testing is confidential. So there is no implementation under test list. There's no pre-validation list. It's either, you know, here's the results of everything that's got through the testing or not. And only the supported profiles are ever listed. So if you miss some of the mandatory requirements in a profile, that profile doesn't get listed. So people don't know whether or not you applied and tried to pass and failed, or simply your product doesn't have that functionality by choice. So where do people use key management systems? So key management systems are actually pretty important within a whole range of uses within effectively a deployment environment. And a fair number of these are interesting to look at. Where does key management actually come into play? So I've just got a little breakdown across effectively things sitting in the storage space on this page, and the range of uses can be as simple as I described before, vaulting an authentication key, or it can actually be ultimate key lifecycle generation for multi-version rekey in a large storage array. And that range of usage is quite different in a context of what is used of the key management system. So we turn around and have a look at what are people actually using the key managers for. Again, from a simple, you know, store me objects through to help me do audit enforcement and device authentication enrollment and support multi-tenancy, multi-jurisdictional requirements. In the virtualization space, people want to basically do everything that they did in the physical space. From a compliance platform, well, you know, compliance always wants to have something to work with. So if you turn around and externalize your key management, then there's more information available to a compliance system to be able to say exactly what's going on. So enforcement of everything that's happening within a system. As soon as key management's externalized, there's a lot more visibility of the cryptographic primitives and the cryptographic operations underlying the system. And when those operations have the additional information and attributes, the semantics attached to them, you can do a lot more in a compliance space. So you can know, yeah, it's this disk in this on this RAID controller in this storage array in this physical location that asked for this rekey to happen at this point in time. And that's not something you get out of, say, a FIPS module that just said some crypto happened. There's also hardware security modules that are doing key management. And in the authentication and identity space, there's a whole pile of key management occurring as well. So you turn around and think about, I've got myself an Active Directory system. What is it managing? Well, it's managing a whole pile of passwords. It's also managing a whole pile of certificates. It might even be managing a whole pile of keys. Isn't that a key management system in essence? How do you control what the information that's sitting in there? So the moment you start touching authentication and identity management, you realize there's a lot of key management going on in pretty much every environment. In the HSM and key management space, this is one of the areas where there's a lot of debate within the HSM vendor community is what's an HSM and what's a key manager. And you know, from speaking from a technical perspective, there is no real difference between the two. Yeah, it's the purpose that you put them to. You can use an HSM as a key manager, you can use a key manager as an HSM. It just depends on the volumes, and the markets that they're aimed at are slightly different, but the capabilities underlying have more in common than they have that are different. And some of the stuff that's basically sitting up here is, you know, key managers are generally aimed at a higher volume of keys. HSMs are aimed at a lower volume and aimed at stricter hardware controls on the keys that are being used. More control over the key usage, which you can get in a key manager, but a key manager is generally about making keys available for use. So in an HSM context, you know, the one thing you really don't want to do is let the wrong person have access to the key. In a key management context, the one thing you really don't want to do is lose the key. It's okay to give it to the wrong person occasionally, but you can't lose it. Whereas an HSM would rather deny operation than give operation to the wrong person. So there's a little bit of a focus difference in how you build the products in those spaces. So if we're sitting in an HSM space and you're trying to do cross-platform usage, you tend to be talking something like PKCS11. There's been previous presentations last year on P11. So if you're a client, you might be talking P11 and you're talking to an HSM. Your HSM might have a key management system sitting inside it. A fair few of them do. And your HSM might actually be talking to a key management server in the background and you just don't know about it. Or if you're coming from the key management side of things, you could be talking to a pure key manager, or your key manager could have an HSM inside it. Or your key manager could be talking to an HSM on your behalf. These are all the sorts of things that are sitting out in the environment today. And of course, in some contexts, you probably want to actually talk to both. You might be aware of both a key manager and an HSM. You might be doing your policy management in a key manager and your cryptographic key protection in an HSM. And sometimes those HSMs and key managers themselves will be communicating as well in the background and cooperating. So when you turn around and have a look at the HSM and key manager deployment models and think about it in a key management context, the whole space in terms of the problem domain you have to deal with gets substantially wider. So when you're no longer thinking all my keys are in this one module in this one location and I'm only performing simple cryptographic operations, the level of complexity of the environment you need to deal with goes up quite substantially. And that's why KMIP is designed to be able to handle a whole pile of things that are just not within the scope of an HSM for its management. And it's fairly straightforward in terms of working through the features and functionality and the differences, but you basically have to step back and take a more holistic view of the world. So that's the main part of the presentation, and I've just got a couple of extra slides sitting on the end here. So since we're at a conference that involves a whole pile of FIPS labs and a whole pile of people interested in FIPS validation, this happens to be the validation statistics split down across every lab since the validation program began in terms of how many modules are validated. That's one of the things that NIST actually publishes, the database of all the validation information, little Microsoft Access database with all details of every module that's ever been validated and every change to every module sitting in it. What they don't do is produce nice pretty graphs like this. But if you're interested, come and have a chat to me later. If you want to break it down in terms of the lab, same information with a line graph. So who turns around and produces which modules? So one of the things you may have detected is last year wasn't a good year for FIPS validations, was it? Not a very good year. Year before was pretty good. The 3 years before that were kind of lean for FIPS validations. And the labs, there's a lot more labs, and they're really competing for a lot more business. If we turn around and have a look at the breakdown, what levels of modules are being handled? So, you know, starting at the bottom, and they're actually in order from level 1, 2, 3, and 4. If we break it down, and how are the levels of modules going? Well, there's quite a lot of variability there in terms of the levels of modules that are being validated. So you may not have noticed, you know, Level 4s don't come up all that often and seem to have been out of favour in the last 4 years. There's been a lot more interest in Level 1 validations than anything else. Level 3s, they just seem to sort of follow steady state. Level 2s go up and down quite a bit. And when you turn around and have a look at it, is what's driving the requirements that are leading to this sort of activity in a validation space? What are customers asking for? What are they trying to achieve? What modules are being produced? And I think it's always useful to turn around and look back at the results of the validation program and try and deduce the questions that led to the behaviour that resulted in those modules being validated. And there were a few of the things sitting in the system, and I think that's the end of the slides. So, Questions. Anybody got any questions about key management, FIPS validation?
I have my question is, like, if I understand correctly, that cable now specifies what kind of functionality would have to be implemented and how this, the request for those functionalities are communicated, but not necessarily how the functionality is implemented. So it could be, for example, if I ask for generate a symmetric key, it could be generated in a FIPS way or in a completely different way?
Yeah. So what came in says is how you would ask for the key. It doesn't say how the server will implement it. Now in version 1.3 of the protocol, you can actually query what sort of validation does the server claim to have? What sort of random number generator? Down to which cryptographic algorithms, which DRBG are sitting inside it. And in fact in 1.4 you have to track which RNG was used for every key generation within the system. So you're not forced to have anything, but you are required to be able to report. Now, one of the reports you're allowed to do, for example, for a random number generator, is the server can turn around and say, I can tell you exactly that the random number generator used is one, I'm not going to tell you what it is, unspecified. Or you can be precise, so that you have to have an answer, even if the answer is I won't give you an answer. Any other questions? Okay, looks like we're going to end early.
Thank you, Mr. Hudson. That was interesting. I do have a comment on couple of his slides. It's not a question, but a comment. Coming from the lab, I do want to caveat some of the statistics that was put up. The statistics from the NIST side on all the labs and how many evaluations or how many certifications that were done are good, but they're not completely reflective of what happens. Anything that doesn't get a new certificate, like one sub, one sub A, one sub B, two subs, four subs, do not get counted. So in coming from the lab, I want to make that clear that it's not a reflection on how the labs do. It's not a comparative reflection. It's just the number of full evaluations or
three subs. Yeah, there is actually a system for us to pick up all the one-sub validations as well.
Okay, awesome. Thanks. Yeah, Chris, you had something.
I want to add to that too,
if you could.
Brought to light that a lot of IGs came out over the last year or two, like IG 975,
right,
that affected a lot of software modules. So a lot of modules went into like hibernation for a long time.
Exactly. And I know that because of the RNG transition, we got a bunch of work and we're still working on those, and they are not what is called as a three sub-like or one sub-like three. Do not get reflected there.
And to add to that, as well, coming from the lab, the 2014 numbers were really high because I can't remember what it was.
Transition.
But 2013, there was one where everyone had to get their submissions in before the end of the year to be able to avoid some changes.
Transition.
So they basically, we were extremely busy for the last 2 months of the year and put in probably half of our submissions in that last 2 months.
Excellent. So Tim, you didn't think you would get so many comments on those three slides, right?
NIST publish a lot more information in the access database than what goes on the NIST site. Yeah. So all of the one sub and three sub validation activity is in the details that are in the access database.
Yes.
So turn around and get a level of the activity.
That's right.
It's pretty amazing. Some of the modules never get touched.
Excellent. Yes.
That information this makes public, it just doesn't go up on this website. So anybody's free to have a look through that information, gather it, or if you wanted to see the graphs for the full set, just drop me an email or I'll send them your way.
Excellent. Yeah, since we do have another 5 minutes, I do want to say a couple of other things that's going to generate more interest here, is that NIST is going to look at all those old evaluations that Tim was talking about from which no activity, nothing has been done, no, not even a once-up, not even to change the name of the owner or whatever. They're going to look at it and transition them, those records to archival list. So that's coming, so be aware of that. I think it's at the end of 2017, Jonathan, you remember? At the end of 2017, right? So be aware of that, and if you need to take some action, even if it has to be just a once-up, that might be of good, you know, might be useful for the certificate to stay alive. All right? I don't want to say yes, but yes.
I'm sure vendors would want to know that.
Yes. You didn't hear it from me, but it's yes, and it's recorded.
I understand that there's a limited window on that. They're apparently going to publish a...
Jonathan, could you please?
Sorry.
My understanding is that sometime through about November of next year, any one sub, including updating a vendor point of contact, will actually extend the deadline, but they're planning to publish an updated thing that's going to put a deadline after that, and once you go past that point, it's going to be much more restrictive on what will extend the deadline. So, yes, in the short term, people could game the system and do a whole rash of one subs to buy them another 4 years or 5 years.
We game the system as known as preserving your investment?
Yeah.
You could do it. You could change it.
So, but after that point, my understanding is they're going to be more restrictive on, and they want to, you know, make sure that if you can't preserve your investment without actually demonstrating that you're complying with some of these new requirements.
Yes, this was discussed in the lab meeting on Monday and Tuesday.
As I should say. That's my understanding of where they intend to go. That, like I said, they intend to publish something that's going to make it more restrictive, but that's not final. The current official final rules are one subs extend. We just got unofficial that they're planning to change those rules.
So if you see Jennifer or Carolyn, do speak to her about it, to them about it. Don't mention my name, though. We still have, I think, 5 minutes more, right? Okay, the next speaker?
Yes. All right. So, I don't know. Mother, your name. So, Denise, right? Denise, not Denise. Denise. Okay. There are Denise. Denise?
Just make sure that you're comfortable with this, and this is the or the keys.
Just use the arrows.
Arrows or the. I'm trying to see.
So I brought some notes because I don't want to forget to mention some things. Should I just leave?
Yeah, we have a few minutes for. Yeah, you can stretch. Walk around, stretch, have a coffee, or have a drink. I think we still have 5 more minutes. So, here's an interesting trivia about Valerie. I'm just looking at it. Those who know Valerie, she's an earlier speaker. She writes a blog on bicycling, beer, and security. Where is that coming from?
I didn't know if you were making an announcement.
No. I'm just filling the time with trivia. Yeah, we can load it.
Yeah, I need actually to enter the pass. So that's the pleasure of working with the government. It's a FIPS approved.
Oh.
FIPS approved. No, you can enter it in the
no,
computer.
No, you can put it.
Okay. But
you can put it on the desktop if you want to.
Yeah, but
you can put it on the
but I need to enter the password.
Oh, this is your encrypted one. What is it?
Thank you. So I can use the mouth, right? Thank
okay.
you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Maybe you need to take it out first. Your device is ready, right? Just take that one first.
No, it's ready to use. So, but the mouth is
not. Yeah, that's why I'm saying that maybe you need to minimize this first.
Okay, I'll take it out.
Oh, I removed the mouth, that's why.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
And do you have a second USB port?
Yeah, there's one more, right?
Right next to it. Okay, thank you. Okay, hopefully this will do things. But I'm not next. I'm the one after.
I'm sorry, you're not
I'm not next one, yeah. So do I have a minute to play with it just to be sure it's loaded?
Yeah, we have a few minutes.
All right, thanks. Do you have a start button here?
Where is this?
Here. Okay. Okay. Now I see.
Where did you put it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and then I do this.
Okay. You can put it on the desktop for now, and then we can put it back on the right.
So you want me to say that?
We're getting a lot of people. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Uh-huh.
All right, looks like
entropy is one of the things interesting.
I think so. It's so fundamental, foundational to what we do.
And intriguing. Right? Valerie, I just made an announcement that you write blogs on bicycling, beer.
Oh, yeah.
I just read it, and then we had a few minutes, so I said, threw that out.
Yeah,
I'm
secure. There's a bunch of blogs
already
out there.
Yeah.
Sorry, I copied it, but where do I paste it? What?
You copied it, right?
Yeah, I just copied
it.
Okay. Yeah.
So go into...
This one?
No,
this one. Let me minimize this. Minimize that.
Yeah.
Here, right?
That's right.
So I paste it anyway here, right?
Yeah.
Let me minimize.
Or you can do it on the desktop also.
Paste. So that's the one.
Okay.
All right. All right. Good, right? Good. Thanks. Good. Thanks a lot. Yeah. So let me make sure I can safely secure. I can just pull it out. But other than... Thank you.
Yeah. Alan, what's your last name? Maguwat Roginski.
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 Nagjin. Okay. I know last time I got it wrong and you said that. Okay, we'll see you, Rona.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.